Welcome to JCEL Jabber, a podcast that is supported by the Journal of Cases in Educational Leadership. In this episode, we meet Ebony Wright, a senior who is slated to graduate from Claremont High School in the spring. Ebony was an honor roll student, captain of the girls' varsity softball and swim teams, and was recently awarded an academic scholarship to attend a highly ranked university in the fall. Ebony was a model student. How she found herself sitting in the principal's office several weeks before graduation was a shock to everyone. So a story like Ebony's is really important because it allows educators to reflect on the function of whiteness in school policies. With a case like this, aspiring leaders can consider the impact of what we might consider seemingly race-neutral school policies.
Yeah, I agree. I like this case also. Here are a few more details found in the case narrative. The authors describe a school that is diverse, rigorous, and engaged with the community. Under the leadership of Dr. Cynthia Adams, the school has flourished. However, one Thursday morning, Ebony Wright, a student leader and athlete, had just finished a long swim practice. Due to the lack of time, she was unable to perform her typical grooming of her hair. Her hair was drying naturally, and when she went into physics class, a teacher confronted her and demanded that she do something to her hair. Ebony stood up for herself and explained that this was her natural hair. This led to a discussion with the principal, Dr. Adams, who seemed to not understand Ebony's perspective. However, Ebony knew the law. You know, it's cases like this that we hope to highlight on this podcast. By the way, I'm Curtis Brewer. I'm an associate professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio. I am also a co-editor of the Journal of Cases in Educational Leadership.
And my name is Ian Mehta. I'm an associate professor at the University of Maine, and I'm on the editorial board of JCEL. And this podcast is called JCEL Jabber.
This case was published in the Journal of Cases in Educational Leadership, or JCEL. JCEL publishes peer-reviewed cases for educational leaders who are in preparation programs, as well as for practitioners engaged in professional development. It is available online. And our goal at JCEL is to build a better bridge between the theory and the practice of educational leadership, a bridge that will help educational leaders create more equitable learning experiences for communities across the globe. Each case provides a narrative and teaching notes. They are meant to be used to prompt rich discussion and inquiry about issues pertinent to educational leaders. Increasingly, there is a need to provide greater access to these published cases. One way to do that is to provide a podcast that highlights specific cases. So here we are.
Right. So in each episode, we hope to provide an overview of a case that is timely and relevant for educational leaders to consider. These cases might include addressing issues of race, crisis leadership, cultural proficiency or supervision, and could also include restorative justice, data-driven equity audits, and special education compliance, among other topics. So jumping into this episode, we decided that for the first podcast of JCEL Jabber, we would look at a case by Dr. Terry Ann Watson and Dr. Angel Miles Nash entitled Challenging Whiteness at Claremont High School. This case was first published online in February of 2021 and came out in Volume 24, Issue 3, which is the September 2021 issue. So when Curtis and I were talking about a case that we thought would be good to start for JCEL Jabber, we wanted one that would challenge readers to think more critically about how policies and practices that often go unchallenged or unnoticed are inherently biased against students who come from historically marginalized backgrounds. These seemingly race-neutral policies, specifically dress and behavior policies, lead to disproportionate discipline rates for Black and Brown youth. And what makes this specific case important is not only a review of how whiteness acts as a social construct to reinforce privilege and power, but also how it can be perpetuated and reinforced, perhaps unknowingly, even by an administrator who identifies herself as a socially conscious Black woman.
Yeah, you know, dress code and its enforcement is an enduring issue for school leaders. Often, the school leaders try to strike a balance of regulating student appearance and simultaneously offering a norm or a model for appearance. Often, schools believe they have achieved this balance. However, as this article points out, these policies are rarely neutral and are rooted in standards of whiteness. While the school may believe that they are addressing the superficial appearance of students, the students know that this is about regulating their identities also. It's about affirming white cultural standards at the expense of others. Ebony Wright, who we met at the very top of this episode, is very aware of this. Simultaneously, Dr. Cynthia Adams, the principal, believes that she is operating from a place of care as she advocates for students to always have pride in presentation. It is this complexity that drives our cases as professional development tools. What at first may seem like an obvious course of action is, on second thought, replaced with the opportunity to discuss the realities of doing the right thing.
So what we're talking about is the importance of JCEL. It offers an opportunity for educators to engage in discussion about topics that help develop progressive leaders. And dealing with a case like this is important because we know that Black and Brown students from across the U.S. continually receive negative messages about their hair, whether it is a natural hairstyle or dreadlocks, both of which challenge whiteness as a norm. These attacks on hairstyles create microaggressions where students must comply with policies that are based on prejudices associated with race, and if they don't, they face suspension, removal from sports teams, or being barred from graduations.
Yeah, you know, and these prejudices are old. Anti-Black sentiment about wearing hair naturally has existed in the U.S. since the enslavement of Black people, requiring enslaved Africans to mimic hairstyles of enslavers or to cover natural hair with scarves. In the 1960s, Black women began to resist straightening their hair in exchange for social advancement. For example, Angela Davis wore an afro as a sign of Black power and resistance against white standards of beauty. However, Black women still face discrimination in their workplace and in schools. Natural hair discrimination can also be seen among Black male students, as recently noted with a wrestler in New Jersey who was forced by a white referee to cut off his dreadlocks or forfeit the wrestling match, as well as a Black student from Texas who had been growing his dreadlocks since the seventh grade and was told he would not be able to go to prom or attend graduation because of hair length.
Right. So we should offer our own positionalities for listeners here. But as two white males, we've never been asked to cut our hair because of how it naturally grows, right?
Yeah, right.
So for white principals who make up 80% of the administrators across the U.S., it is all the more important to be aware of policies and practices that perpetuate whiteness and to help deconstruct these systems of oppression.
Before we bring in our first guests, the authors, we should mention the Crown Act, which is an acronym for the Create a Respectful and Open Workplace for Natural Hair Act.
Yeah, so in the case, Dr. Watson and Dr. Miles Nash give the reader an overview of the Crown Act, which protects against discrimination of people based on hairstyle, texture, or hair type. And we will ask our guest authors to expand on the importance of the Crown Act in a minute, but for the listener, you should know that it was first passed in California in July of 2019, and has since been passed in several states, including New York, New Jersey, Virginia, Colorado, Washington, Maryland, Delaware, Connecticut, New Mexico, and Nebraska.
All right, so let's bring in our two guest authors, Dr. Terry Nicole Watson, Associate Professor of Leadership Development at the City College of New York and recent Distinguished Visiting Scholar at the University of Buffalo's Center for Diversity Innovation, as well as Dr. Angel Miles Nash, an assistant professor of leadership development at Chapman University. Terry, Angel, welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for being here. So as we mentioned above, you made sure to describe the principal, Dr. Adams, as a socially conscious Black woman. Why did you make sure to use that language?
Thank you for having us, Curtis. And I'd like to begin by addressing our intentional use of language and labeling Dr. Adams as a socially conscious Black woman, because as Black women ourselves and scholars of color, it's important that we speak to the realities that many of us are challenged with. Too often, particularly in places that we call schools, Black folks in particular adopt ways and ways of being that are not affirming to nor for Black children. And Dr. Adams, although she meant well in her critique of Ebony, she was wrong. She was not only wrong, but her practices in many ways should be considered anti-Black. And it's important to point out that Black people can also be anti-Black, meaning that we too follow ways and norms that don't affirm us in order to fit in to places where we don't feel familiar nor comfortable. But if schools are to be safe and loving spaces, then we must show up as ourselves and celebrate young children when they come in as their selves and wear their natural hair. And we wanted the school principal in particular to be a Black woman and to have this dichotomy, if you will, because we know that many Black school leaders struggle with this reality in trying to harness their Blackness to fit into a structure that was never intended for us to begin with. So in many ways, we wanted to not only free Black children, but we wanted to free Black school leaders also and invite them to come in and to be themselves, especially in the schoolhouse, because that's where we're needed. And when I say we as Black folks in our true selves.
Yeah. And, you know, in that interaction at the end of the case narrative, Ebony starts to realize that Dr. Adams and her don't see eye to eye and says, but Dr. Adams, what about your crown? Angel, why is that an important statement or question that Ebony asks?
So simply put, Curtis, Ebony wanted connection. And to an extent, she relied on that connection in her schooling experience. So in search for that connection, Ebony assumes that Dr. Adams possesses, she offers the query as a reminder. The response floors Ebony and creates necessary tension in the case for us to be able to offer educators the opportunity to reflect on the ways that students look for empathy, understanding, and alignment in educators as the adults who shape their reality in schooling spaces every day. Ebony's question reminds us of a few important aspects of educational leadership to include in our work. First, there is an importance of representation at every level in schools and education, at the district level, at the school site level, and everywhere in between. Secondly, the pride that youth carry for their identities is part of that connection that Ebony wanted to create and assume she had with Dr. Adams in their interaction and prior to their interaction. And that shock reflects for her the undoing of an assumption of safety and vulnerability that she thought she could rely on in her schooling space in her senior year of high school. And finally, there was identity-based tension that can arise in generational differences based on identity and one that informs students' experiences. And that is what teaches them about their existence in schools as well as their belonging or their sense of belonging that we are tasked to affirm in their time there with us.
Can you talk a little bit more, Angel, specifically, I'll ask you this question. How would you like to see this case be used in PD within school systems?
Absolutely. Thanks for that. Great question, because that is our hope, that educators will engage this case in their work with their school site, again, at the district site, everywhere that they see the usefulness of this work. So we would encourage educators to consider and reconsider how their school and district policies can perpetuate oppressive and or marginalizing practices for students of various backgrounds. We recognize that is a reality that our students face, that it has not faded away as much as we put work into doing so. And so us bringing attention to that through the unveiling of the Crown Act through this case and this space was a part of our work and our intention. We would also like to encourage educators at varying levels, district administrators, school site leaders, teachers, and school staff to arrange to have their policies on hand or on screen to immediately dissect and unpack their own rules that are intended to support and protect students that may in fact manifest differently based on students' cultural experiences, their backgrounds, and their way of presenting themselves as a recognition of the historicity of the way that schools have viewed and treated students in the past and even in present day.
So there's nothing more powerful, right, than being able to connect theory to practice. And I so appreciate your response to that, Angel. Terry, the next question is for you. What might you say to educators who question how the legal and education systems in the U.S. often serve to reinforce whiteness as the accepted social norm?
Well, thanks for the question, Ian. In short, schools are microcosms of society, and as legal precedents are shrouded in anti-Blackness and promote white supremacy, so does the schoolhouse. As educators and educational leaders, we must recognize the function of race and racism in society and intentionally create policies that encourage practices that deeply consider race and the function of racism. Moreover, we must consider the impact these policies and practices have on the well-being of all children.
So I'm going to try to do a follow-up question really quick for both of you. I mean, you might have feel like you've spoken to this already, but what made you want to write this case? As someone that's written a few cases in JCEL, I always have something, you know, I experience something or I see something in practice and I have an idea of why I want to write a case. Can you tell us a little bit more about why this case was so important for you to write?
Well, to begin, you know, as Black women, it's important that we have perspectives and agendas, and we are clear about that. And I think through our research, we should make it clear not only who we are, but whose we are, meaning who does this work belong to? And this case study in particular belongs to Black girls and Black people in general who feel disregarded or disrespected in the schoolhouse because of the distinct ways in which we style our hair. You know, hair for many of us is cultural, is spiritual, it's a form of personal expression, and too often it is regulated in the schoolhouse in manners that is not done to other children, meaning children of color and Black children in particular are often called out because of their hair, because of our hair in the distinct way it grows out of our head and how we choose to style it. And so while other children are given the freedom to express themselves in this manner, Black children are constantly recoiled, stopped, harassed, disregarded, and too often punished. And so schools become one of the many places where marginalization is experienced firsthand. And as Black women and as a mother, I wanted to push back on these harmful policies and practices that do the most damage, because I think hair is such a personal part of us that when it is, you know, disregarded or discounted, we do take it personal. And the personal is political. So we spoke out about it. And this case study is the end result of a conversation that we had based on our realities as Black women and as scholars.
Angel, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. I'll echo what Dr. Watson mentioned and then just add to it that this is a first. This Crown Act is a first of its type to offer protection against discrimination for natural presentation, natural state of being for Black people. And so because it was a first, we thought that it should be added and championed for the recognition of the policymakers that stand behind it, for the girls that it represents and protects, and for the boys it represents and protects, for the educators who are on the front line having to operationalize this policy and stand up for the students who have been historically discriminated against. And we thought that it was important to get it in writing. JCEL has certainly highlighted the experiences of Black girls before, and we appreciate that. But once this policy came about as a first, we thought we could add to the growing coverage of Black girls' experiences in ways that does not look at them in a deficitized manner, but instead creates an opportunity for them to feel like they belong in schooling spaces and in policy in ways that are looking to highlight the assets that they bring to both contexts.
So before we bring in our guest scholarly practitioner, is there anything else that you would like to just quickly say to the listener about this case and what you hope they might get from it?
I hope that it is a springboard, a genesis, if you will, for more digging and undoing of other practices that may be found to be discriminatory to other students. We hope that it helps all educators and educational leaders at different levels in their work to begin to unpack very tangibly and viscerally what students are going through. And we hope it just becomes a catalyst for other types of countering in ways that produce, you know, qualitative and acknowledgement of how students are experiencing their schooling spaces and how they can be supported and protected in meaningful and intentional ways.
That was awesome, Angel. I'd like to simply add that if schools are to be safe and loving spaces for all children, then we must make them all feel welcomed. And by doing that is by, you know, valuing not only their presence, but their physical presence, meaning how they look and the clothes that they wear. And while it's, you know, we may say it's just hair, you know, it matters to some Black girl, to that Black girl in Louisiana who was forced to leave the schoolhouse and couldn't take school pictures because she came in with her hair braided. And instead of being happy and celebrating her, she was demonized and asked to leave the schoolhouse. So this case is for, again, like Angel said, you know, children everywhere, but, you know, Black boys and girls in particular, to let them know that there's people watching and aware of what happens in schools. And we hope this case study is applied effectively with both an E and an A, because, again, if schools are to be safe and loving spaces, then we have to welcome all children and their hair.
Dr. Terry Ann Watson and Dr. Angel Miles Nash, we are so grateful for you being with us on our podcast. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for your joining us. And I love the E and the A.
All right. So we've heard from our two guest authors. So now let's hear from our guest scholarly practitioner. Dr. Teresa Lance is Assistant Superintendent of Equity and Innovation at U46 in Elgin, Illinois. She is also incredibly accomplished at bridging the gap between theory and practice and has written several chapters for other scholarly practitioners. Teresa, welcome to the show, and how are you?
Thank you, Ian and Curtis, for having me. I am doing great because I know I'm sharing some airtime with my two sheroes, Dr. Miles Nash and Dr. Terry Watson. So I'm doing great.
Fantastic. So, Teresa, I'm going to start by asking you a question, then I'll pass it off to Curtis. How would you discuss this case with a group of leaders within your district, and what outcomes would you hope for?
Well, first, again, let me just thank the both of you, Curtis and Ian, for allowing me the opportunity to speak to this case. And again, I want to thank Dr. Miles Nash and Dr. Watson for writing such a timely piece that depicts the experiences of so many of our Black children. And I can see myself in Dr. Adams, you know, in trying to do the right thing. But then I can also speak to one of my daughters who was recently dress coded equated to receiving a behavioral infraction. So not necessarily about her hair, but what she wore. And this is my daughter's a straight A and B student. So this story, this case study really spoke to me. And then the teacher who dress coded her is a Black woman. And this Black woman said that this was a violation of school policy. So when I consider the practical application of this case study, the first thing that comes to mind is sharing the article with the school leaders. So we have more than 50 schools in our district. I would also share with my cabinet colleagues who are all white, and then ask them to consider how our current policies exist and how they intentionally or not exclude or harm students of color. For example, I'll never forget, I was a superintendent, which is one of the reasons why I relocated to Illinois. And the conversation came up from my board members, again, who were predominantly white, around whether or not bonnets and hoodies should be allowed. And so for school leaders, I think it's important for them to consider at least one student who was either excluded from school and how that harms them because we use our own values and beliefs, which are predominantly white focused, to harm children.
So you're mentioning that, you know, we want to avoid harming kids, right? Which is somewhat common sense. But, you know, I think it's important to help leaders see how whiteness is operating through their schools. How might you help leaders do that?
Well, this is such a loaded question, and I'll do my best to respond given the limited amount of time that we have. For starters, I think we need to help leaders see how racism operates within a system. For example, we've all seen countless videos and social media of teachers engaging in egregious acts. The most recent example I can think of is the teacher who was making fun of Native American or indigenous culture while trying to teach math concepts. As a result, we were quick to call for the teacher to face some disciplinary action, specifically firing. However, we failed to look at the entire system that allowed that behavior and similar behaviors to go unchecked. So as a result, I suggest that we have to begin to examine how racism is at play systemically, institutionally, and at the inter and intrapersonal levels within the schoolhouse, and more specifically within the entire school district. For example, examining district policies, that would be the systemic level. How are our hiring and promotion practices, because it's one thing to say we want to recruit teachers, but then we keep them there. We don't want to allow them to move up through the system. So who sits on these hiring and promotional panels? And then I think we need to consider how we embody practices. What are the implicit biases that we hold that create harm, as another example? And so that would be my recommendation.
Thank you. I really appreciate the way you talked about each level, right? And that it has to be understood is as systemic. You know, is there any thoughts you had that you, when you were reading this case, that really stood out to you that you want to make sure to share with the audience?
You know, I know our authors talked about the inequities and the harms that exist. I think it's even important for leaders, especially leaders of color, to really reflect on how they might see themselves as Dr. Adam. Because I was a Dr. Adam, you know, and I need to acknowledge the fact that there was a place and time when I was thinking about excluding students because of their dress, not necessarily hair, but their dress, because they did not live up to these expectations that were really handed down to me by a white dominant society. And so how do we see ourselves and act as Dr. Adams, as the case study described? So it's not just here's the case study and how are we harming as white folks, but again, as Black folks, how do we harm students as well, intentionally or not?
Well, I really want to appreciate and thank you for taking the time to be part of our podcast here. Your perspective is invaluable, and I can't express how much we appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you both for having me, and thank you to our authors, Dr. Miles Nash and Dr. Watson.
If you'd like to access this article, please visit our special collections page on our website, which we will link in the comments. Every 90 days, we'll post 5 to 6 articles that will be available to everyone. If you'd like to see our whole body of work, please visit your local university library or talk with Sage Publishing about a subscription. If you have questions, you can email me directly at curtis.brewer@utsa.edu.
And I'm Ian Metta. You can email me at ian.mette@maine.edu. You can also follow me on Twitter @IANMETTE. And we look forward to joining you next time on JCell Jabber. Yeah.